I believe that success comes with character, and that success builds character. I don't believe, as apparently some people still do, that suffering and defeat are necessary for developing the soul. I know they're not good for the body or the mind. Failure doesn't make you feel better, either mentally or physically. Of course, it's an inevitable part of life, and you do yourself a favor by taking the opportunity to learn from your failures. But I think there's no point in continuing to bang your head against the wall once you realize it hurts. I don't mean to sound hard-hearted about this, but I believe that if you reach a certain age, and if you really haven't achieved very much in your own terms, I don't think you can ascribe this to bad luck or a difficult childhood or any other external factor. I personally feel that your strength of character does come into question at that point. And let me make it clear that your definition of success may be different from the next person. I'm not implying that you need to have a fat bank account or a Rolls Royce to be successful. But if having those things is integral to your definition of success, then that's what you should be aiming for. Let me illustrate what I mean by describing the philosophy of a very successful and interesting man named Steve. Although he was still in his mid-40s, he had already founded a very profitable advertising firm in the Midwest and had sold it to one of the country's largest agencies for roughly 3 times his company's annual gross. So he had become a very wealthy man, and he had plenty of years left to enjoy it. During a discussion with some friends of his, the topic turned to the career problems of a mutual acquaintance. A man of obvious intelligence who had an MBA from one of the most prestigious universities in the country, his high level of ambition had led him to strike out on his own as soon as he got his business degree. But now 15 years had passed, and his consulting firm was still hard-pressed to pay the rent on his office. Oddly, he still continued to impress everyone who met him as an extremely sharp all-around businessman. He read the Wall Street Journal every day. He knew the names of all the CEOs of the major corporations. Talk to him for 5 minutes and you would think he was a real player in the business world, but he had never made any money. Steve's friends were confused by the whole idea of a good businessman who's never had success in making money. They felt it was like saying someone is a great baseball player, but he strikes out all the time and makes a lot of errors. Steve thought about this for a minute and then offered his perspective. In the business arena, I believe achievement is a prerequisite for calling someone successful. You can't be a good businessman and never make any money. A good tree bears fruit. If it doesn't, it's not a good tree. I think Steve's analysis is right on the mark for a certain segment of the business arena. In certain professions, one of the highest goals you can achieve is to generate income for the company and thereby fatten your own bank account. In those businesses, success is measured by money, plain and simple. So if you're in that type of profession and you haven't made money, you probably should take some steps to strengthen your character. In other words, character isn't an abstraction that exists somewhere up in the sky, divorced from the real world. There may be other things you should do also, but you should certainly do some soul searching and some character development. But let's broaden the scope of the discussion a bit and look beyond business success, where the measurement of achievement can be defined simply in terms of dollars and cents. I've already said that in my opinion you need a strong character to make money, and that if you haven't made money, your character very likely needs work. But I also want to stress my belief that it takes character to achieve success in any form, whether it's in the business world or anywhere else. There are some people who just aren't interested in making a lot of money. I'm not one of them, but I can see their point of view. For these people, achievement is measured in terms that aren't so easily quantified. There was once a small dinner party in a beautiful home located in the Hunt Country of New Jersey. The host was heir to a fortune that began when his grandfather, invented the first milking machine, but he had long since distanced himself from anything that at all smacked of life on the farm. He was primarily an investor now, though he and his wife were also very involved with philanthropic activities. On this particular evening, they had convened a gathering of successful people from several different walks of life, providing a vivid example of what winners have in common, regardless of their particular field of endeavor. In attendance was a prominent attorney, an investment banker, and an owner of one of the largest automobile importing businesses in the country, each accompanied by their wives. But the person who dominated the conversation was a slightly built, impeccably attired gentleman from New York City who spoke with a mysterious European accent and was known only by the host. From the beginning, the topic of conversation for the evening seemed to be opera. Those who were present were clearly eager to take advantage of this fellow's presence, to listen respectfully as he discoursed on his favorite subject. Neither the attorney nor the car importer nor the banker were what you'd call opera aficionados, and their wives didn't seem very knowledgeable about arias either. It was just something about the personal magnetism of the slightly built fellow. There was a genuinely charismatic quality that made everyone want to hear what he had to say, even on a subject that might be remote from their own interests. He spoke mostly about the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, though there were allusions to Milan and Paris. With regard to the Met, he offered detailed critiques of all the previous season's performances, as well as his impressions of individual singers. This was followed by views from behind the scenes that made it clear that this man held some administrative position with the Metropolitan Opera itself. He definitely wasn't just somebody who bought a ticket. Names of significant benefactors of the opera came up, prominent individuals in the business community, and it was clear that this dapper little man was on a first-name basis with these people. Then, after holding forth for well over an hour, he suddenly seemed to grow tired, and with profuse apologies, he informed them that he would be leaving. There were protestations from those present, but the slightly built man explained that he really had no choice. There was a matinee at the opera the following day. He would have things to do, and he really couldn't afford to be at anything less than his best. "So what can I do?" he said with a sigh, a little smile, and an exaggerated shrug in the European manner, and a moment later he was gone. There was a quiet moment after he departed, a void that would have to be filled. By this time the guests had all moved from the dining room to the library, where a dessert wine was being served. Finally, one person in attendance took it upon himself to ask what exactly it was that the departed guest did at the Metropolitan Opera. Was he the person who scheduled the programs, probably years in advance? Was he the person who made the creative decisions? Shall we do a little light opera here and then a big tragic one there? Or was he more involved with the business end of things, the person who negotiated with the artist's agents and put his foot down financially when somebody started getting too big for their britches? After a moment's hesitation, the host answered the question. "Well," he said, "that man who just captivated us for 2 hours, that gifted raconteur, who had just held us spellbound with tales of divas and maestros, is the same man who runs the coat check room at the Metropolitan Opera. During the performances themselves, of course, no coats are being checked, so he's free to slip into the back of the hall and listen. I'd venture to say that he's heard every note that's been sung or played at the Metropolitan Opera in the last 20 years. In all the years that I've observed and studied and pondered the laws of success and the variations of human character, I don't believe I've ever heard a better example of self-possession and aplomb than that man." As he left that night, every guest had pictured him returning home to an elegant Park Avenue apartment. Now they had to substitute a one-bedroom apartment in an outlying district of the city, or maybe even a furnished room someplace. There was no way to know for sure, since none of the guests had any idea what they paid the man who ran the coat check room. But what did it matter? He was his own man. He had truly achieved that. And how many men could say as much, regardless of their incomes or net worths? You've probably come across many people who provide a very different kind of example. People who really let the air out of the balloon. This tends to happen more often as individuals move into middle age. You can recognize them on the street. They walk along with their head down, moving at a snail's pace. When I talk about developing character, these people don't know where to begin. As they see it, it's pretty hard to focus on character when you've got credit card payments to make and 100 other things to worry about. Well, here's my opinion. If these people had given a bit more thought to building a strong character over the years, maybe their credit card payments would be a little more manageable at this point. But it's never too late. According to Aristotle, 52 is the age at which a man's philosophy is fully formed. But it's okay to run a little behind schedule as long as you recognize it and do something about it. And you don't need volumes of books or the library in order to create a personal philosophy that will help you to achieve your goals. You can do that anywhere. You can do it right here. In fact, we could all do ourselves a favor by developing the philosophy of an ant. There are at least two reasons why ants are unique and important. For one thing, an ant always knows where it wants to go, and it keeps trying to find a way of getting there, no matter what. If you put a pebble in front of an ant, the first thing it does is try to find a way around the pebble. It tries to go one way. If it can't get around there, it tries to go the other way. And if it still can't get around, then it tries to climb over the pebble. And if for some reason it can't climb over the pebble, it will try to lift the pebble, even though the pebble may be hundreds of times larger than the ant itself. And if it finds it can't lift the pebble, it will look for other ants to help. And if all the ants working together can't lift the pebble, they will finally start digging a tunnel underneath it. And even if that doesn't work, they will literally start trying to gnaw their way through the pebble. How long will they keep trying? They'll keep trying until they die. Because the one thing they will never do is quit. That's the ant's philosophy of achievement. And we might all want to incorporate it into our view of the world. The other reason ants are important is because of what they do in the summer. During the summer, the ants plan for the winter. They don't have any credit cards. They don't use the present moment to create debts and liabilities for themselves in the future. They use the present moment to create assets for themselves. Do you remember the fable about the ant and the grasshopper? The grasshopper laughed at the ant for working so hard all summer. The grasshopper just enjoyed himself, leaping around in the high grass without a care in the world. And when the winter came, he starved to death, while the ant had plenty to eat. Remember, we've all been grasshoppers at some point in our lives. Just make sure you're not one now. Character is the means for transforming ideas into achievements. It's somewhat abstract in the sense that you can't lay your hand on it or point to it or weigh it on a scale. But in a very real sense, character is what allows you to get where you want to go. If you want to drive from your home to a store on the other side of town, you'll need an automobile with gas in the tank. And you'll need keys to start the car. But you'll also need to know how to drive. You'll need judgment based on life experience to tell you when to step on the brakes if the light up the street changes to red. You'll need a true intention to reach your destination so that you don't keep stopping for coffee and a piece of pie every 10 minutes. You'll need to know how much time to allot to the trip so you can get home in time for whatever else you have to do. And you'll need enough maturity to call and say you're going to be late if you get stuck in a traffic jam. You can't lay your hand on any of those things and you can't measure them with a yardstick, but they're as important to reaching your destination as the car or the gas or the keys to start the engine. They are analogs of character. Let's continue this comparison for another moment or two. There are all sorts of ways to keep track of the condition of a motor vehicle. You can look at the tires to see whether they've worn out their tread. You can look at the odometer to see how long it's been since you've changed oil. And you can turn on a switch and then walk around the car to see if the headlights and the taillights are working properly. There are objective indicators of the condition of your car. Similarly, there are ways of objectively evaluating your achievements. Most people don't take advantage of them as often as they should, but they're available nonetheless. For example, you can put together a financial statement in order to determine your net worth. You can hire an appraiser in order to learn the market value of your house. You can compare where you were 10 years ago to where you are now in order to determine the degree of progress you've made in your life. As I've tried to explain, achievement depends on character in the same way that a successful drive to the grocery store depends on knowing when to apply the brakes and when to step on the gas. But how can you know if your character is in good enough shape to get you where you want to go? To continue the metaphor we've been using, there are ways of discovering whether you still know how to drive without having an accident. I believe there are ways of evaluating the strength of your character that are almost as clear as the depth of tread on a tire or the amount of gasoline in the tank of an automobile. In order to use these techniques for character evaluation, all you need is a commitment to be ruthlessly honest with yourself. At first, that kind of ruthless honesty may include a little bit of pain, but once you accept the fact that character is basic to achievement, you'll gladly pay the price. Just as the gas gauge of a car indicates full and empty, with several demarcations in between, you can learn whether your character has enough fuel to get you to your life's destination. You can learn to tell whether you're on full or empty or somewhere in between. But while a car runs on only one fuel that is indicated by a single gauge, character, in my opinion, can be evaluated by four different imaginary gauges. Here's the first one. On the right-hand side of the gauge, corresponding to the letter F for full on a gas gauge, I want you to imagine the letter R, which stands for refusal. And on the left side of that gauge, I want you to imagine the letter C, which stands for complacency. If your character is good and strong, there are certain things that you simply refuse to accept in yourself or in other people. In your work, you refuse to accept anything less than your best effort. That doesn't mean that things will always work out exactly as you hoped and intended, but that's not the point. There will always be variables you can't control, but your effort level should always be maxed out regardless. With your family, your commitment should be just as strong. You should simply refuse to compromise in any area where your family needs and welfare are concerned. And with yourself, in your personal life, you should similarly refuse to accept pettiness or dishonesty or unethical behavior in any form. That's the right-hand side of the first character evaluation gauge. On the left-hand is the letter C, which stands for complacency. But it also could be the letters LIS, standing for let it slide, or even WTDA for what's the difference anyway. Ask yourself where you stand on that scale. Do you have enough good, strong refusal to achieve what you want to achieve? If not, it's time to make a pit stop right now. The second character reading gauge has the letter D on the right, and on the left is the letter M. The D stands for decision, and the M stands for maybe. Ask yourself, are you a person who comes to a fork in the road and turns right or left, Or do you stop the car, scratch your chin, and say, well, maybe I'll go this way, and then again, maybe I'll go that way. And in the end, you go nowhere. Think about the big issues that are facing you in your life right now. It could be that you want to leave your job and start a business of your own. It could be that you want to get married. In any case, are you the kind of person who comes to a decision and puts it into action? Or are you someone who says, well, maybe, but then again, maybe not? Now imagine a gauge with a W on one side and an A on the other side. The W should be in bright red or orange, while the A should probably be a dingy green or pale yellow. That's because the W stands for want, as in, I want it now, or I want it real bad. Or I want it so much I'll do whatever it takes to get it. The W means you'll go to law school for 5 years at night while working full-time during the day because you want to be a lawyer. The W means you'll get up at 4 o'clock in the morning every day to work on your novel because you want to be a writer. It means you'll travel from one end of the country to the other many times in order to find a doctor who can make your child well. I know people who have done all those things because they wanted something, and eventually, they got it. The A stands for apathy. That's where you really don't care what happens. And if you really don't care what happens, it's just as well, because it certainly isn't going to be anything good. Now we come to the last of our imaginary character gauges. On the right-hand side is the letter P, and that stands for promise. And on the left-hand side is a letter F, and that stands for fear. If you are a person of strong character, you will promise yourself that you will achieve your goals or what? It doesn't matter, because you never consider that possibility. You have made a promise, and you're going to keep it. When you set out to drive to the grocery store, you don't stop at the doorway and think, what will I do if I don't make it? You simply intend to get to the grocery store. You know you're going to get there. You will get there. It's simply assumed. Fear is simply the inability to make a promise to yourself. It kicks in when you start thinking about all the bad things that can happen to you on the way to your destination. And before long, you're thinking, wouldn't it be easier just to stay home? Isn't it safer to just stay in bed? Isn't it better to pull the covers up over my head? In this discussion, we've been using the metaphor of going across town in a car. Let me conclude by referring to another little excursion, and it's one that I know for a fact you have already taken. When you were learning how to walk, you made a silent promise to yourself that you were going to do it. It may have been scary at times. You surely stumbled again and again. Tears surely fell from your eyes, but no matter. You didn't even think about that. Each time you fell, you forgot about it as soon as you regained your feet because you had promised yourself you were going to walk across the room. And you did it. How long did it take? Who cares? You did it. And at that point in your life, you had the strength of character to overcome fear and keep the promise you'd made to yourself. Do you still have that strength? Whether you realize it or not, you do. When you were that little child we've been talking about, you asked yourself, how long am I going to work to realize my dream of walking across the room? And you instinctively answered, as long as it takes. Make that same promise to yourself right now. Making it takes strength of character, and as I've tried to show, strength of character is the foundation of achievement. I can promise you that. One of the most remarkable books ever written is entitled Coming Out of the Ice by a man named Victor Herman, who passed on a few years ago. It's an autobiographical account of the author's struggle to survive during 14 years in a series of Siberian prison camps. all of them located in the far north near the Arctic Circle, during the years of the Stalinist regime and the Soviet Union. In the first few pages of the book, by way of introducing himself, Mr. Herman declares that he is one of the toughest men on the planet, if not the toughest. And whether or not you are prepared to take his word for it now, as he tells you so, he is absolutely sure you will agree with him by the time you've finished the book. And he's right. By the time you've finished the book, you'll know that over the course of these few hundred pages, you've been in the company of the toughest man on earth, physically, mentally, and spiritually. This was definitely a man with a very strong body and a strong character to go with it. Victor Herman had been born in Michigan, but he had moved to Russia during the 1930s when his father went there to work in a factory built by the Ford Motor Company. Victor Herman, who was in his early 20s at the time, was also arrested for being politically unreliable and was sent to Siberia. The philosophy of the Soviet prison system at the time was very simple. Prisoners were simply worked to death. In the Arctic cold of the Siberian winters and the mosquito-infested, unbearably humid summers, the camp inmates were given one impossible task after another. With inadequate clothing, impossibly poor equipment, and almost no food, faced with this kind of existence, a prisoner would inevitably lose his will to live, and death would occur not long afterward. Victor Herman was an amazing exception to this rule. Though he had no real hope of a life outside the camp, though he had nothing to live for in the sense that most of us are used to, there was something inside him that refused to be broken, just out of sheer stubbornness, just out of sheer strength of character. At one point, a special task was arranged for Mr. Herman, something the camp administrators were certain that he wouldn't survive. Early one frozen morning, he was sent out into the forest with only a single guard accompanying him, and there he was shown several dozen full-sized trees that had been cut down and stripped of their branches so that they could be used as telephone poles. He was then ordered to single-handedly load the trees onto some railroad flat cars before the end of the day. It was literally an impossible task, like something out of a fairy tale or a bad dream. But Victor Herman did it. Somehow he did it, simply because he refused to be beaten or to give up. It was a miracle, but it actually happened. It was a feat that dwarfed the accomplishments of any Olympic athlete. And as it happened, Victor Herman was in an excellent position to make that particular judgment, since after his release from the camps in the 1950s, he became coach of the Soviet Olympic boxing team. The author of Coming Out of the Ice performed many heroic feats during his years in Siberia, but he considered the incident with the telephone poles to be his masterpiece. As he worked, he was watched by only the armed guard, who just stood there silently throughout the day, probably half frozen to death himself, and undoubtedly completely dumbfounded by what was happening before his very eyes. When the impossible job was finished, Victor Herman could not resist walking up to the guard and throwing his arms around him. This incredible display of physical and mental toughness simply had to be celebrated somehow, even if only with a Russian prison guard in the middle of a vast Siberian forest. As Herman described it, the guard allowed him a brief smile, and then the two men trudged back to the camp, where Herman endured many more years of incarceration before his eventual release, his remarkable Olympic career, and finally, his return to the United States after almost 30 years in the Soviet Union. Victor Herman's amazing story certainly deserves to be told, and I believe there's a great deal to be learned from his accomplishments. But it's not what you might think. I'm not going to suggest that you can be like Victor Herman or that you should even try. In fact, I think the value and the extraordinary power of his story lies largely in the differences between what this man accomplished and what we can expect of ourselves. To me, the most amazing fact about Victor Herman's survival is the fact that he found motivation entirely within himself. Nobody cared whether he lived or died. He had no reason to think he would ever have a life outside the prison camps. It was made obvious to him throughout every minute of every day that his captors were simply waiting for him to give in and growing more and more impatient about it all the time. To me, the fact that Victor Herman managed to maintain his will to live under these conditions of total isolation is even more amazing than the things he accomplished with his body. Very few people are able to develop this kind of intrinsic motivation. That's just an axiom of human nature. Most of us, virtually all of us, in fact, need reasons outside of ourselves in order to accomplish anything of significance. We can still be people of strong character, but we need something outside ourselves to help us become as strong as we can be. Just sort of wanting to be financially successful is rarely enough to make it happen. Just wanting to learn a new skill, or give up a self-destructive habit, or make some other major change in your lifestyle usually won't cut the mustard. But what if you had to get a large amount of money in order to afford the very best medical care for someone you love? What if you had to learn how to speak a new language in order to save a family member who had been imprisoned in a foreign country? Or if you had to change your way of living in order to find a way out of some other life or death situation? Your motivation would move to a much higher level. If you're like most people, having to is a lot stronger than wanting to. But often, and especially when you're young, that difference isn't always clear until someone points it out to you. In my own life, it was my mentor, the late Mr. Earl Schoaf, who pointed out the distinction between wanting to on the one hand and really wanting to, or even having to, on the other. By doing so, Mr. Schoaf did me a great favor, and after we'd talked about this, I felt for the first time I was really pointed in the direction of success. The way it happened was really very simple and straightforward. Mr. Schoaf simply took me aside one day and said, "Jim, you have enough talent and intelligence to really accomplish a lot in life, but you just don't have enough reasons to make it happen." When I heard that, something clicked inside my head. This was truly a key insight, a turning point in my life. I had always doubted if I had enough ability to be successful, but suddenly I realized that having enough ability was not the problem. The problem was having enough reasons. I'm no Victor Herman, and frankly, I doubt whether you are either. We don't have the willpower to achieve success in a vacuum, as if we were standing out in the middle of a Siberian forest loading logs. We need all the help we can get in terms of motivation. But of course, different people are motivated by different things. I've read a number of studies on motivation, and the ones I've found most convincing have isolated four main factors as the most powerful human motivators. I'll go through them one by one, and I urge you to listen to them carefully. Think about how you can put them to use to help you to accomplish your goals. And if you're in a managerial or leadership position, think also about how you can use them to help motivate the people you're supervising. These are the real factors that make people get off their behinds and do things. These are what works when wanting to just isn't enough. These are the true reasons for believing something is worth doing and then for actually doing it. The first great motivator is recognition from peers. When soldiers in wartime give up their lives during combat, why do they do it? Is it because of patriotism or belief in the cause they're fighting for, or fear of court-martial if they do otherwise? Perhaps all those things play a part, but extensive research has shown that what really motivates a soldier to fight well in combat is the desire for the respect of the man who's fighting right beside him. This is much more important than medals or other forms of public recognition, which in the confusion of wartime are often given to the wrong people anyway. And what motivates soldiers in combat is only an extreme version of what motivates salesmen on the floor of a car dealership, or students in a classroom, or a team of lawyers trying to win a case. I don't know if this is still done, but for many years the players in the National Football League used to select their own all-star team at the end of each season. I was always interested and rather amused by the differences between the player selections and the all-star team picked by the fans or sports writers. And I'm also certain that the honor of being selected by one's fellow players meant a lot more than any sort of recognition from someone sitting up in the grandstand with a hot dog in his mouth. Quite simply, recognition from peers is a truly powerful motivating force in any human activity. The second important motivator is recognition from respected experts or authorities. I can tell you that in my own life, this has been an extremely important factor. Mr. Schoaf, whom I mentioned a moment ago, was someone that I respected from the first moment I was introduced to him. And he was also someone whose respect I desperately wanted to earn. Has there been someone like that in your life, or is there such a person in your life right now? It's important to realize that a respected expert doesn't have to be a person who's known far and wide throughout the world. You are the one who establishes the qualifications, though very often, people who you find impressive will be equally impressive to others. Once you've met such a person, or even if you've seen them from a distance, or perhaps read an article about them in the paper, don't hesitate to politely approach them and introduce yourself. Unless you happen to catch them at a particularly difficult moment, most successful people are eager to help others and to pass on what they've learned. Sure, I was apprehensive about meeting Mr. Schoaf when I first saw him, but I shuddered to think what my life would be like if I hadn't done it. From a motivational point of view, the great thing about establishing a relationship with a mentor is that you eventually become so close to that person that you can almost hear them advising you, even when they're not really there. Earl Schoaf passed on years ago. He died suddenly at the age of only 49. But I still feel like he's talking to me every day. I still feel also that I want to earn his approval and respect. I think it will always be that way. Family is the third great motivator, and in many ways it's really the most powerful. Although the approval of peers and experts may be most important in your career, in your life as a whole, nothing can compare with the importance of your family. An experience I had a number of years ago is a good illustration of that principle. I had just finished giving a talk before a group of entrepreneurs up in Minneapolis when a young man approached me and asked me for some advice about achieving financial success. As I always do when asked for that sort of advice, I began with a couple of standard, straightforward questions. The first one was, how much money would you like to make annually? When I ask this question, I want to see whether the person has given enough thought to his goals so that he can come up with a specific figure. That's a much better sign than someone who just says, I want to make a whole lot. But this fellow was even more specific and focused than I could possibly have expected. I need to make at least $250,000 a year for the next 10 years, he said without a second's hesitation. And why do you want to make that amount? I now inquired. This was another standard question of mine, and once again he answered immediately. Mr. Roan, he said, 10 years from now, when my kids are old enough to enjoy it, I want to take my family on a trip around the world that they'll remember all their lives. The trip itself will last for 12 full months, with no expenses spared. And in order to save enough money to make it happen, I will need an annual income of $250,000 for the next decade. There were literally tears in his eyes as he said this, and although I haven't heard from him since then, I have no doubt that he'll achieve his goal. In my mind's eye, I could picture him over the coming years working long hours, meeting deadlines, overcoming obstacles, doing everything it takes to be successful today, and doing it gladly. After all, he was motivated by something more than just simple desire for financial success and the material rewards that come with it. This man was working because he desired to give his wife and children a lifetime's worth of priceless memories. And if that isn't a reason to believe, I don't know what is. A person who can feel that level of emotion for other human beings is truly blessed. And a family who can have that sort of man for a father is truly blessed as well. The fourth and last achievement motivating factor I want to mention is closely related to the desire to benefit your family. In fact, you could say it's a desire to benefit the whole family of man. Let's call it the impulse toward benevolence, toward sharing your wealth and wisdom with the world. I'm fond of a story about Andrew Carnegie, the Scottish immigrant who founded the United States Steel Company in the early years of this century. When Carnegie died, a yellow sheet of paper was found in his desk on which he'd written a note to himself when he was still in his 20s. This note set forth the main goal of his life. It read, "I'm going to spend the first half of my life accumulating money, and I'm going to spend the last half of my life giving it all away." Did this impulse toward benevolence provide to be a strong motivator for success? Well, during his lifetime, Carnegie's fortune was estimated at $450 million, the equivalent of $4.5 billion today. And he did have the joy of giving it away. In addition to building Carnegie Hall in New York City, he founded libraries in hundreds of small towns all across America and participated in dozens of other philanthropic activities as well. When we look at the four important motivators I've just discussed, what do we really see? The thing that I immediately notice is that they all involve other people. Whether it's peers, mentors, family members, or simply fellow members of the human race. It's ironic, isn't it? In order to be successful, you need this very internal, very personal, very unique thing called strong character. But in order to acquire that innermost quality and set it to work, you need people other than yourself as reasons to believe. Maybe that's not true if you're the toughest man on earth. Maybe then you can do whatever needs to be done just because you set your mind to do it. The thing is, though, there's only one toughest man on earth at any one time, and I'm not the one. And I'm kind of glad about that, too, because needing and working for other people is really what's made my life worthwhile. And I'm sure you feel the same way. Within each of us, there's a kind of imaginary measuring instrument. I'm not sure if it's a scale or a calculator or a compass or a combination of all three, but it's always working. It's always taking readings. It's always balancing temptations of every kind. And there are many, many kinds. Against the benefits of living ethically and with strong character, when the temptations outweigh the benefits, that's all it takes for some very unfortunate things to start happening. In my opinion, and I think there are very few exceptions to this, a bad person is simply somebody who doesn't have enough reasons to be good. We've talked about all the ways in which other people and your attachments to them can help build character and success. Now I'd like to look at the various qualities we've discussed in this program. And I'd like to show you how each one represents a definite commitment on your part, a risk, an investment that you know you will lose if you fail to live up to the standard you have set for yourself. But every time you make that commitment, every time you take that risk, you tip the balance of that internal scale back in the direction of character and steadfastness and doing the right thing. After all, whenever you make a commitment to one of the traits we've discussed here, in a sense, you're making an investment. So that if you were to start living in ways that run counter to those traits, you'd lose the investment, wouldn't you? And no one likes to lose investments. Once that starts happening, it's not long before you're broke. Courage was the first quality of strong character that we discussed. We saw that courage is not the absence of fear, but is indeed the presence of fear for the right reasons at the right time and of the right thing. We should not fear failure, for example. Anyone can fail, and virtually everyone does at one time or another. Many outstanding leaders in every walk of life have failed many times and have gone on to greatness nonetheless. But if we should not fear failure per se, we should fear failure to do our best. We should fear failure to live up to the ideals we set for ourselves. A great poet once said, "All men would be cowards if they were brave enough." I think there's some truth to that. So embrace your fear, take it inside yourself, and use it as a foundation for true courage. We then considered a pair of qualities that are closely related, honesty and integrity. We saw how telling the truth can be painful in the same way that paying off a debt can be painful. There's a temptation to hedge and equivocate, just as there's temptation to run up large balances on credit cards. But credit buying doesn't make long-term sense in either finances or ethics. In both areas, the interest charges will eat you up. But in the first case, it's only your bank balance that will be destroyed. In the second case, it's your soul. Perseverance was our next element of strong character. We saw how reserve energy is a mark of strong character in any field, and how successful people manage to reach down into themselves for the strength to overcome any challenge, whether external or internal. And we learned why goals are as important to achievement as a net or a baseline, or the ability to keep score is important to tennis. You may become an excellent player without them, but that's not likely. And anyway, how would you ever know? We considered responsibility as an element of strong character, and we saw how most people will do almost anything to avoid it. But we learned also that individuals who seek out responsibility, those who want the ball when the game is on the line, can gain material and spiritual rewards that naturally flow from strong character and the glory that comes with leadership. In our discussion of wisdom, we saw why the desire for it can never be satisfied, and why that very impossibility makes wisdom even more desirable to those who truly love it. We saw how Socrates and Solomon, though different in many ways, were united in their ability to act wisely, and we learned why Socrates' seemingly foolish decision to die unnecessarily was really the fullest expression of his doctrine that wisdom is knowing thyself. Humor, though not often considered a quality of strong character, has proven to be a very important one, particularly in this country, where we see the ability to laugh at oneself as evidence of trustworthiness and fundamental integrity. But in our discussion, we also saw why humor must be handled carefully, and why the difference between saying something funny and being funny oneself is something that should never be forgotten. In Session 7, we looked at flexibility as an element of character, and we saw why it's critical to success in every human undertaking. Flexibility is strength without rigidity. It means recognizing what can be controlled and what is beyond our control, and behaving accordingly. It means playing the cards that we're dealt as best we can, and resisting the temptation to think that the deck is stacked against us. Patience, like flexibility, was discussed as an aspect of character that helps us not only cope with the unpredictabilities of fate, but allows us to turn them into the material of success. Patience is the quality that lets us enlist time as an ally, instead of fighting hopelessly against it as an adversary. It's the hallmark of true maturity. Its presence distinguishes the strong character from the weak, and the mature adult from the unfinished, unformed child, whether he's 3 or 33. We discussed confidence as both an intrinsic element of character and as an emotional commodity to be invested in others. Confidence is the ability to inspire trust, yet it can only be achieved by trusting, both in yourself and in the people you meet. If you're truly a confident person, your belief in yourself is strong enough so that the world itself seems safe and oriented toward your success. It's one aspect of a strong character that can literally change the way we perceive reality. Good health, which we considered in Session 10, is an aspect of strong character because it springs from wise choices. It's neither a religion, a diet, an exercise program, or the number of calories that we've consumed in a 24-hour period. Rather, good health expresses an awareness of who we are and how we should live in the most fundamental sense. And finally, in the last session, we saw how achievement identifies a strong character in the same way that blossoming fruit identifies a healthy tree. By taking to heart the principles and techniques that you've heard in this program, you most certainly can build an unshakable character. And I have no doubt that success of every kind will follow. And because I have no doubt of that, I'd like to close the program with a few thoughts about how to handle success graciously and wisely when it comes. As you're struggling to achieve your goals, as you're working to break out of old behavior patterns and to overcome the obstacles that will inevitably befall you, I'm in favor of using any means necessary to make progress, as long as it's legal and ethical. If you want to motivate yourself with anger, and many people do this, I say go with whatever works. If you feel you've been wronged at various points in your career, and you look forward to gaining sweet revenge once you reach the top, I say whatever gets you going. But now I also say, when you do achieve success, put all that behind you. Take the anger that you used as fuel to climb to the top of the pinnacle and throw it back down to the bottom. That's an act of strong character, really strong character. But it's also just plain smart. Do whatever it takes to get where you want to go, and when you get there, live well. That's your concern, to live well, with courage, with honesty and integrity, perseverance, responsibility, wisdom, humor, flexibility, patience, confidence, good health, and achievement. Your concern is to build an unshakable character, and once you've built it, to keep it strong. And I have no doubt that you will do exactly that. Thank you for joining me.